from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson. Every single Pixar movie ever made was absolutely terrible at first. They ended up great by the time you and I saw them, but it took a lot of creativity to get them there. Not just creative storytelling, but creative ways of leading the team of storytellers. That is one of many revelations in the new book, Creativity, Inc., written by Pixar's co-founder. Ed Catmull is president of the Emeryville-based studio and of Walt Disney Animation. We'll get his insights on how Pixar learned to help its artists thrive, sometimes learning the hard way. Ed Catmull is our guest for the hour, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Here are six words that will tell you just about everything you need to know about how Pixar makes great movies. Ready? Story is king. And trust the process. That is the distillation of many years of experience, trial, error, calamity, opportunity, and one of the most amazing adventures in the history of cinema. Pixar started as a division of Lucasfilm that George Lucas sold off to Apple's co-founder, Steve Jobs. Today, it is one of the most valuable divisions of the Walt Disney Company. Pixar's movies have won 9 Academy Awards and made billions of dollars around the world, but at the heart of it are story and process. Ed Catmull is one of the technical and creative leaders who helped build that process. He co-founded Pixar and is its president today. His new book tells the story of how the studio came to be and what he has learned along the way. It's called Creativity, Inc., Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. Ed Catmull is our guest for the hour. Ed, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. What tips or tricks about the creative process would you like to know more about? What creative challenges affect you or your organization? And, of course, what's your favorite Pixar movie? Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Ed Catmull, if you and I drove over to Pixar right now, and I'd love to, by the way, thanks for offering. If we drove over, what is the first thing I might notice that would reveal how the studio makes great movies? What might strike me first?
Well, the first thing you would notice coming onto the lot is that in front of the building, there's a big soccer field.
A soccer field?
Yes. And every day people are out there using it because we are trying to take care of people physically, although not everybody plays soccer. The second thing you notice when you come in the building is the atrium, and it's the energy in the atrium. This building was designed under the direction of Steve Jobs. In fact, we called it his movie. Because he didn't actually participate in the making of the movies, but he directed the building. And what we have is a place where everybody crosses at the center. It was a cultural idea that people should cross and have inadvertent encounters. So you walk in, and there at the center is a crossing space. We have 3 theaters for making the movies, our eating area, all our meeting rooms, the restrooms. So people cross, and you walk in there, and you feel things going on. And it's really critical to the environment that there be these interactive interchanges and accidental interchanges going on.
So it's kind of a place where a friend of mine would refer to it as intentional serendipity, where things can just kind of happen, but you create an environment that facilitates them happening.
Yes, and it's a critical point that it's the intentional serendipity is that you think about the environment that you are in, that you design for it. And then designing for the environment, you are then allowing other people to do things that you can't foresee.
I want to talk about your work at Pixar and how Pixar came to be, but just on a day-to-day level, I mean, you co-founded Pixar. That's a big deal. And today, you're not only an executive at Pixar, but Walt Disney Animation. How does that strike you, just personally?
Well, to some extent, you know, it's like the fact that they were founded so long ago, it's now back in the history. So I have to look at, okay, what are the things going on today and how do we interact with people and what are the challenges? Because there are certain assumptions that, like Pixar, that we've got it figured out. And even if people read the book, they might come away with the assumption that we've figured it out. But the real message is that we don't have things figured out, that we have continual struggles and all the kind of fears and issues that people have exist now because they're part of us as part of our human nature. And really the challenge, the ongoing challenge for us, as for any group, is how do we face the fears and the challenges and the uncertainty that's out there? How do we make it safe?
Safe to be challenged and safe to be out of your comfort zone.
Yeah. If you think about failure, which is something that because we have a lot of internal failures, we try not to release our failures to the outside world.
Right.
But internally we have them. But as you know, it's fairly popular today to say, well, you learn by failure and you embrace failure. And everybody kind of says that.
Or fail forward fast, that kind of
yeah.
thing.
And we say it too, but there's a problem. And one of them is that we have two very distinct meanings of failure. And one is that almost academic one, which is that's how we learn and we grow from it and we recognize that. But the other one is comes from our childhood, where if you fail in school, it's because you weren't dumb or you screwed up or something of that sort. But even more current, when you listen to the news or read the papers, if somebody in the government or in a major corporation makes a mistake, there are opponents ready to pounce on it and bludgeon them. So there's a real aura of danger around failures. So you just can't ignore it. And we have to realize that we have inside of us both meanings, and they coexist. So there's that real fear that's there, and the other one is all it's part of learning. If you can understand that both are going on, then you can help put the fearful part into perspective. And it's not that we ever get rid of the fear entirely. But if we put it in perspective, then we can learn to work with our failures and embrace them because they are really part of growth and change.
One of the quotes from the book that I think kind of addresses that fear of not only failures but also of the failures that might be around the corner, you write, there is the problem you know you are trying to solve. Think of that as an oak tree. And then there are all the other problems. Think of these as saplings that sprouted from the acorns that fell around it. And these problems remain after you cut the oak tree down. There's this legacy of additional things that, you know, if you're afraid of the failure that sprouted this tree, get ready, because there's got to be more coming that you can't foresee.
And they will always be there. Well, it's a hard thing to accept because our goal somehow is to do things smoothly because we think that's the goal. And the way we try to look at it is the real goal is to do something good in the world that touches people. It's whatever our product or contribution is, but that should be a real goal. And the process around it should be to support that. But we shouldn't somehow get so focused on the process that it displaces the real goal. And I think that happens in a lot of places.
Let's back up a step and talk about Pixar, how it came to be in computer animation. One of the first projects that you talk about in the book was this landmark computer animation project to animate something that to us now would seem fairly simple, which is a human hand. And the animation of the human hand, wherever you are listening to this, if you just take a second and look at your hand and notice the fact that your hand has no straight lines on it, the idea of getting a computer to not only draw the curvature of your hand, but the curves within the curves from one joint to the other, from one surface of your hand to the next, from your thumb to your index finger, just is a nightmarishly difficult puzzle. But it got done, and you were there kind of around that time when it was happening and the potential for computer animation began to become clearer.
Yeah, so I was taking a class, and at that time, computer graphics was very crude. Everything was made out of polygons, unless they were spheres or something really simple like that. So we had projects, and people were using the tools that were there, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to take something which was incredibly hard. So that's why I picked making a movie of my left hand. So I digitized it, I put in the polygons, and I came up with a language to animate it and wrote all the code to do it and then published as a paper. So this is back in 19, 72 or 3, something like that. So this is a long time ago. But there's something exciting about picking something which was, at the time, basically impossible. But it was so exciting that it set me on the course of saying, okay, what are the steps we have to go through to get to the point where we can make an animated film? How do we actually make curved surfaces? How do we put texture on them and light them?
What made you decide to want to make a film, an animated film, rather than just finding new ways to animate objects? I mean, like a story, a narrative with images.
Well, growing up, the one thing I did realize, because I had two childhood idols, one was Walt Disney and the other was Einstein. And with Walt Disney, he was telling stories, and as a child, I was influenced by these stories. And I, of course, watched him on television, but I understood, even at that time, that stories are the way we communicate with each other. So, I mean, we're on the radio right now, but you tell stories and you hear stories all the time, and it's a way of communicating. We tell stories to our children, and it's really deeper than just entertainment or something to to keep ourselves busy by reading a book or whatever. It is our way of communicating. And having watched that and been influenced by it, I also accepted something else at face value that Walt Disney said, which a lot of people didn't get, and that was he used what was the advanced technology of his time. And we look back on it and we say, well, that filmmaking is not advanced technology. That's old technology. But it wasn't old when they started.
Right.
And he was telling people that all this cool stuff we're doing with color and sound and multiplane cameras are part of our process. And I always thought of them as integrated together. So when it came time to use when it became possible to use a computer to make pictures, in my mind, this was an extension of what Walt had actually started off with.
So it didn't seem quite so foreign to you. It just seemed like next logical evolution.
Yeah. And you know, there's a story that I tell when I give talks sometimes. I will say that when I got out of high school, I realized I couldn't draw well enough to work for Disney, so I switched over into physics. And the interesting thing is the audience always sort of titters or laughs at that because they
including
think,
me, yeah. Of course.
but what I found interesting about this is that almost everybody thinks that art is incongruous with science. And I didn't view it that way. And even today, I realize that most people think of art as like learning how to draw. And so, of course, because that's not a big profession, it's usually the first thing that's cut in schools when they have problems. But my view is that the purpose of art is not to teach us how to draw. It's to teach us how to see. And if you think of it in terms of—
To teach us how to see?
To see, to observe. That's really what art is about. And when you take those classes, you are observing the world and you're capturing, you're paying attention to what's going on. And if you develop those skills of observation and seeing what's going on, then that skill is useful in science, in medicine, in engineering. And that's the value of it. But it's the one that people kind of get backwards because they're looking at an end product and it's almost like the wrong term for it. It's like we should be offering to young children seeing classes, not drawing classes.
How did Pixar come together? It was a division of Lucasfilm, as I understand it, that
yes.
George Lucas was spinning off. How did it come to be a place where people began to think, we're going to make a full-length animated computer animated movie?
Well, while there were a few of us out in the academic world who believed this was the potential, the only person in the film industry who saw the potential was George Lucas. Now, he had just made Star Wars, and Star Wars used what was the most advanced technology for the effects of that film. So George reached the conclusion, which was completely unusual in that industry, was that technology was actually one of the driving factors underneath the energy of that film. So I was brought in to bring in high technology for computer graphics, but also for video editing and digital audio. And so we started these research groups in every one of these areas with George funding it. then at some point, because of the changing finances of his company and because we wanted to make an animated film, that was the people we brought in. So John Lasseter came in at that time, and we had Alvy Ray Smith and Bill Reeves, a lot of really cool people of the field at that time. And we wanted to make the film, and that wasn't an animated film, but that wasn't what George's goal was. He wanted to have the technology for it. So the division was sold to Steve Jobs. So Steve then came in as the investor. He had just been kicked out of Apple, and he had just formed Next. And so Pixar was the only other thing he invested in.
I imagine that having Steve Jobs as your investor, and you talk a lot about your relationship with Steve Jobs in the book, was both, I'm sure that relationship was both challenging because we've heard about how mercurial Steve Jobs is, but also you talk about how strong a defender he was for Pixar, how well he kind of protected the soul of what it was that you were trying to do in ways that I think might surprise people in terms of what we've heard and what people have said about Steve.
Yeah, the surprise comes, and it's the thing I try to address in the book, is that Steve went through an arc in his life. It's like the classic hero's journey. He's, you know, the prince is cast out of the kingdom, then he wanders around and he learns a lot and then comes back a changed person. So we start with Steve just after he's been kicked out, and that mercurial side of him I saw. I mean, that was part of who he was. But Steve was so smart that he was realizing that some of those behaviors didn't work very well. And so about 15 years ago, he altered the way he interacted with people. He became more empathetic. He realized that he wasn't trying to win everything, that the best thing he could do was to form equal partnerships. Now, what's interesting about this is after he changed, all the people who were with him during this change stayed with him through the rest of his life. So that change was never talked about because nobody was going to talk about Steve, including me, when people ask about it. So the image is of there's the public image of Steve from when he was young, and then there was the success of Apple and Pixar, but they didn't know who that person was like at that later stages. And for us, he was this phenomenal protector. We had gone through failures together. We all knew we had each other's backs and we trusted each other.
We're spending the hour with Ed Catmull, the president and co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios. Please do join the conversation. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Find us on Facebook and tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Toy Story. You talk about the process of making Toy Story, that first full-length Pixar animated feature, which is one of the best-known, best-loved animated movies of any kind, won an Academy Award for Special Achievement, spawned a series of movies. Toy Story 3 went on to make $1 billion at the box office and became this great phenomenon. But as you describe the process of not only making Toy Story, but transitioning into, oh, wow, we're a successful studio now, we have to keep this going, it seemed like that was a moment where you kind of survived a frying pan and ran into a big fire. Because as soon as that success came, the creative challenge, the creative stakes got higher, the attention was greater, the organization was growing, and now you've got to manage creative success without losing the thing that allowed you to have the success in the first place.
Well, for me, it was an interesting personal challenge to go through. Because I started off with this goal of making a feature-length film back when I was in college. At the time, I thought it would take 10 years to solve the problems, and it actually took 20 until Toy Story came out. But we had this central organizing principle, which is to make that film, and other people came along and bought into that, John Lasseter and Steve Jobs. When the film came out, it was the achievement of that goal. But then having achieved that goal, while we were busy, as you pointed out, we were now in the fire because we had to make more films. We had all these challenges in front of us, and we went public a week later. At the same time, I personally felt lost, and it took me a year to figure out what the next challenge was. And the challenge came from the realization of watching Silicon Valley companies and watching Disney and so forth, that when companies are successful, they frequently go off the rails. And what I could see was something mysterious was happening inside of companies that made them do dumb things. And the implication for me was that we would do dumb things too. So could we look out for them? And in fact, we were looking out for them during Toy Story, and we still did some dumb things. That after we got through, it says, oh, how could we miss this? And so it was during that year I realized, okay, the real challenge is how do you make a sustainable environment? How do you set up a mindset in a group so they can keep on addressing problems as they come up?
Let's grab a quick phone call. We're coming up on our first break, but first let's go to a call from Kimberly in Emeryville. Kimberly, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm a neighbor of Pixar. I have a food innovation company in Emeryville right across the street from them, so I'm very excited to be on the phone. And I have a quick question. We have a creative process, and we have an arc of the story of where we take our clients from this white space innovation into real products. And I find that our team gets to a place much quicker than our clients. And we need to get them there, connect the dots for them in a way that they don't feel like we're leading them. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about creatively how to help people get to a place where you are along the way, you know, when they're not kind of getting there as quick as you get there.
Excellent question. And actually, our experience with it comes before we made Toy Story, when we were making commercials and we had to deal with Our job was to deal with clients, and that's the business that you're in. Is you have people who've got problems that want to get solved, and our particular solution was one of first of all trying, or we're conveying a message to them by asking deeply a lot of questions about their products and what they wanted, and John was actually making most of the commercials, and he conveyed very deeply that he was interested in everything about them. And the fact that he conveyed that was a big help. And the other, of course, was to bring them into the process. As you point out, sometimes the clients actually don't get certain things because to some extent they're like they're lost in their own product and they've lost objectivity.
It's like the forest for the trees problem.
Yeah. And it's the same thing happens to us in all of our films. The director gets lost.
In all of your films?
In all of our films. It doesn't matter how experienced they are. Is if you are in that directing a film, you eat, live, and breathe it, and you lose objectivity. And so while I talk about the brain trust, one of the roles for the brain trust is that colleagues are there helping you see things.
And we're going to explain the brain trust when we come back from the break, but go ahead.
Yeah, so what everybody needs is an outside force to help them see things. So and yet people resist the outside force. So in this case, you're talking about clients to see things, so you want them to know that you're on their team and you have their interests at heart, but then help them as an outside force to see things. I know I'm being kind of abstract here because it's a difficult problem, but I do understand what you're going through.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Ed Catmull, the co-founder and president of Pixar Animation Studios and the author of the book Creativity Incorporated. As we play out, we play the theme to Monsters Incorporated, one of my absolute favorite Pixar movies. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Glad to be with you today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're spending the hour with Ed Catmull, the president and co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios. Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Let me get to a couple of emails now. Terry writes, Dory's classic line, just keep swimming, remains my mantra and inspiration during tough times. And I'm a 51-year-old woman. Keep swimming, Pixar. Love Dory. There's a new Finding Dory movie coming out. Is it 2016?
You know, I actually forget the year. We have so many things going on, I can't keep the date straight. But you're right, Finding Dory is coming out.
Yes, so. Indeed. The sequel to Finding Nemo. Ken writes, would you talk about breaking the barriers of the command structure? I'm reading your book now and just read the part about how the creatives bristled at having to go through channels for ticky-tack stuff. I had a friend who worked for Walt Disney in the 50s, and he said Walt encouraged everyone to speak their minds without fear, regardless of their position. If a janitor overheard a story conversation and came up with a gag that they used in a cartoon, he was paid $25 cash and told to come back with more. How do you break down that command structure and the barriers therein?
Well, it's a tricky proposition, because if you think about any organization, because you do need some kind of command structure. Somebody has to make decisions, and if you're making a movie, you've got hundreds of people working on them. It's also hundreds of people coming up with tens and thousands of ideas. So one needs a way to navigate that. But part of human nature is that people come and they see, okay, where am I in this? And so they start to make decisions about whether or not it's safe to say something. So the communication starts to conform to just going through the right channels. And that was the problem we had on Toy Story, was that the management, not wanting to lose control, that is the management of the production, gave messages that everything needed to go through the channels. And what we realized at the end of the movie was that the communication structure has got to be completely separate from the organizational structure. They're two separate things. Anybody has to be able to talk to anybody at any time. Now, I can say that, and people might nod their heads and say, well, that's a good idea. I like that idea.
Nice for you to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what happens, though, is that managers who are insecure will give signals that they don't want to be surprised, or people will defer to them. So the natural tendency, without thinking about it, is for people to do that, which means that we have to continually be on our guard for the fact that people will sort of fall into that. So part of breaking it down is being aware of it and realizing that that is human nature. It's going to be there. It still happens inside of Pixar. It's a continual challenge to try to get everybody to say what they think. But we all benefit when that happens.
Another question from a listener who wrote by email. Great discussion. It is definitely true that the story is the king. Time and again, the Pixar movies have proved this philosophy. I want to know how the stories are created at Pixar. Is it that some author just tells or writes a story for Pixar, or stories arise out of a group of people discussing ideas at Pixar? If, for instance, some common person like me has an idea, can Pixar consider making a movie out of it? What's the process for that? Where do stories come from at Pixar?
Okay, excellent question, because there's a misconception there, and that is that you come up with this story, and then once you understand the story, you just go make it. I mean, it seems like a really simple process. We don't take stories from the outside. It's not that we've got a rule against it, but coming up with the germ of an idea is not our problem. So what we do is we select somebody that we think can tell a story and has the skills to lead and the emotional connection to have to put something into the story.
And so, it's often, I should interject, no Hollywood studio takes just unsolicited submissions. You all have, there's always a channel that someone has to go through. So that's common.
Yeah, that is correct.
Right.
It's like they just don't take things over the transom. They'll send them all back.
Right.
But in our case, we always start with the person. And then we ask the person to come up with some ideas. We want to come from them, because that's what's going to tap into their emotions. And we want them to come up with more than one thing, because they can get stuck in a cul-de-sac. But in coming up with multiple ideas, then we find one that resonates. And when I say resonate, it's like we feel like there's an emotional connection there. So if you take something like Ratatouille, a rat that wants to cook, or Up, you know, an old man floating away on a house, then those aren't ideas that are obvious that they're going to be big commercial successes. But it was clear that there was an emotional resonance in the making of the film, and that's what we wanted to tap into.
Emotional resonance.
Yes, and the ability to put in with characters that we can relate to, and then you invoke a world that people can understand.
Before the break, you mentioned the Brain Trust at Pixar. This is a group of people who helps to guide the story and the creation of a film and gives feedback. But one of the things that was interesting to me about the Brain Trust, which differs from a lot of organizations I've been involved with, although I guess, you know, we're kind of egalitarian here at KQED, but a lot of work groups I've been in, is that the Brain Trust has zero power over the film. The director has the power of the film. All the Brain Trust can do is advise. Why is that?
Well, we found it somewhat accidentally. It took us a while for us to evolve. The first recognition is the director has to lead the film, has to lead the crew, has to lead the story. And it's a very scary thing to go through. So if you walk in and present it to any other group and that group has the authority to override you, then you come in with a defensive posture. And so what we learned was, if we can make it so that the power dynamics are out of the room, then people are freer to talk and the director is freer to listen. So that's the ideal. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't other places there where decisions are made about things. We're actually talking about, as Brent, just like a particular meeting or an offsite. And it's in those meetings in the offsite where you try to remove the power dynamics so that the group focuses on the problem and not on themselves or somebody else. Am I going to embarrass somebody? Am I going to embarrass myself or do something stupid? If we can do that, then we have a freer discussion. And I will say that in general, this group works very well. Once in a while, it melts down. That stuff gets in the way. And to this day, that still happens. Usually it works well, and every once in a while, magic happens. We don't record these things, so you can't capture it. But all of a sudden, you see a group click into this flow of a focus on the problem, and you see all of the individual egos disappear, and the stories take these amazing strides forward. And it's just like phenomenal when it happens.
Let's talk about the people at Pixar. One of the things that you mentioned in the book is, and I forget the exact, I'm searching for the exact words that you use, but essentially that the primary, here it is, the focus on people, their work habits, their talents, their values, that is absolutely central to any creative venture. You tell a story about, I believe it's the production of Toy Story 2, in which an overtired artist comes to the studio with their infant child in the back seat and realizes after a few hours at work that they left the baby in the car in the heat, and you were able to revive the baby. The baby was fine, but that kind of and that a third of the staff ended up with some kind of repetitive stress injury through the process of the movie. I mean, I think it would surprise people how grueling, like physically grueling, this kind of intensive, you know, draining creative work can be.
Well, it is. If in our case, we had overachieving people working for overachieving managers. Right. And they really,
which is always an interesting combination.
Yeah, it's a good combination, yeah. Right? So the end result is that people can get hurt, and when we never wanted to do anything that was so short term that we were succeeding in the short term and fail in the long term, and so we realized at the end that we had let this go too far down that path. So we felt, okay, we have to change our behavior in terms of training everybody to take care of themselves physically, not working too hard. And what that really means is some people, in order to impress others, will work more than they should and not even report it necessarily, because we don't want them to be there too much time. Now, there are spikes in any film, or like with any project at any company. There are times when, you know, all hell breaks loose because you've got this deadline. But you don't want this to last a long period of time. And that's where the strain came from, was because this was an 8-month sprint. But it altered our way of thinking about things and how we helped prepare people for this.
Somebody just asked on Twitter, and I should raise this question. The book is called Creativity, Inc. Will you be at any booksellers or any place where people can interface with you one-on-one on the book, maybe get their copy signed?
I don't actually have anything planned coming up. I did stuff when the book first came out. All this is exciting, and you know, I signed books and so forth. But the truth is, I still have to run 2 studios.
You got this day job.
I've got a day job. And I have a young child at home.
Well, there's that. Day job and a child. And so you're booked.
Yeah, so I'm kind of overdoing it. Say, okay, it's time to put my focus back in the right place here.
Let's go back to the phones. 866-733-6786. Scott in Palo Alto. Scott, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to leapfrog off of something you just said. You know, you've got these meetings going, and then all of a sudden the egos of the collective falls away, and then this amazing thing comes out of that. And I think that's a common thread in all creative endeavors. And when you ask somebody, how did this come about? And you say, well, I just lost track of time. I lost track of myself. And this creative beauty came out. And I wanted to ask you, Jess, what do you think is, number one, the key to allowing the ego to fall away and to allow that creativity to flow forth? And then what do you think is the cause for us, the majority of the population, to have such a strong ego to where it's something that we have to constantly contend with in the creative process? Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, so the cause of that ego and the way to make it fall away.
Well, okay, so I will. So here's an admission I'll make. This is when Toy Story came out. Now, I knew at the time that Bill Reeves and John Lasseter and Pete Docter and Lee and all these and Andrew were part of making it. So I had no illusions about that, and Steve was part of making this happen. But I asked a question of myself in that year after the movie came out, and that was, how much of our achievement was because of me? And it was like a secret question. And so over this year, while I'm trying to figure out what the new goal is, at the same time I got this question, without devaluing anything that anybody else did, was how much of it was me? At the end of the year, I realized it was a bad question to be asking. But I realized that I did ask it. And I recognized that a lot of people ask that question. How much of this is me? And frequently people come up with the wrong answer. If you actually look at most of the environments, our connections, our dependencies, our interdependence in these others are very profound. And it's really important to understand and value them and not even go to the place of saying, okay, what is my contribution? It's what is the connection with the others? Because the fact is, people have so many different ideas and viewpoints that if we can make it safe for them to add, then the combined set of ideas is so far greater than any one person that it's amazing. And if we can get our head into that space and get out of an ego space, we end up ahead. But I recognize it's a difficult thing because there is that secret question.
I want to pivot to something that came up last year in regards to a settlement that Pixar was involved in. There is an ongoing case that relates to deals that were allegedly made between some of Silicon Valley's biggest companies promising not to poach workers from one another, to hire workers away. Pixar was involved in a separate case that was settled, that was resolved. You were deposed in the case. It's been reported very heavily. I wonder what I guess the reason the case struck me personally as someone who just loves movies, less as a journalist, but just as kind of a Pixar fan, is I guess I figured that the pool of talent in the Bay Area, particularly of creative and technical people, is so deep that there would be no need to have these kinds of gentlemen's agreements, that there would be so much talent and so many opportunities. And in your book, you talk about people at Pixar not working under contract because if you want to work there, you'll work there because you believe in the organization and not for the money. I guess just even the presence of that allegation and the settlement that followed kind of surprised me for a company like Pixar that should just be able to be the place people want to go and want to stay.
Well, it is the way we think about all these companies and the fact people have moved back and forth between the companies the whole time. The particular allegation came from somebody who took something out of context, not knowing any of the other stuff or how things worked. And the conclusion was so wrong that, you know, it was startling. For me personally, it's hard to even talk about what appearing to be defensive, but it was so counter to what we believe that there isn't anything to even say about it. I do believe that the pool talent is deep. And I do know that some of these companies get in wars with each other. But throughout Pixar's entire history, because of our approach of engaging with the community, like we publish everything. And the reason we publish isn't because we're giving away ideas. It's that by engaging with the broader community, then the really smart people come here and join with us. And the result is we've got a very deep pool. The whole entertainment industry is one that attracts a lot of people right now. It's also going through some stress because other countries are giving tax credits. So at the moment, there's only one major special effects house left in the United States, which is ILM. All the others have gone overseas because of tax credits. And California hasn't done anything about it.
Let me go to the phone. Stephen in San Francisco. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Actually, it was what Mr. Catmull just outlined there, but I had I'm a visual effects artist in the Bay Area, and I was just wondering if he could justify sort of to the animation and visual effects professionals in the area, sort of his involvement in those in those dealings. And like I said, he kind of just touched on it, but they just seem so morally contradicting when we're hearing about all this sort of, you know, creative, feel good kind of stuff, and you know, promoting sort of that creativity, but then somehow you can have this sort of underlying action that you're doing that's sort of, you know, just undermining all that creativity and promoting people to want to do a good job, I think, personally.
Yeah,
so Steve, you could just sort of justify that.
Yeah, Stephen, go ahead. Well, yeah, thanks for making that point. I mean, some of the things that, you know, the website Pando Daily has covered this very heavily under the banner Techtopus, this supposedly multi-tentacled network of powerful Silicon Valley companies that have made these deals. And some of the things that you had apparently said in emails that became part of the court record and also in depositions were kind of give another view of the competition between studios in Hollywood and here in the Bay Area. How do you look back on that?
Well, the conclusion they reached was so completely wrong. He talks about this sort of like ethical difference between the two. And the fact is, the conclusion is not me. It was just totally wrong. It didn't represent what happened at all. I mean, I didn't even know how to do it. It's sort of like, when did you stop beating your wife? I mean, somebody makes that and it's just not even correct. So, I mean, it isn't what I believe or at the time either.
But there was this kind of a gentleman's agreement between the studios saying, hey, we've got our team, you've got your team, let's just keep it the way it is? I mean, did that agreement exist?
Here is the thing is people – we know and we've always known people can go back and forth. We were sister companies with ILM, and since we traded technology with each other, then we were careful not to go in wars. But the fact is people went back and forth between the studios, and they always have, and there was never anything to prevent that from happening. My belief throughout all of this time was that people should be at a place because they want to be there. And that's the way we've always worked. It's the way we worked at Disney. We had a place where they were under contracts, and what it was doing is it was altering the relationships between the company and the people. And we want it so that it's because people want to be there. And the reason is I want to know if there's a problem. I don't want to have something which is hidden awake. And that's one of the fundamental principles is bring the problems to the surface.
Let's continue our conversation with Ed Catmull. We'd love you to get in on the conversation as well. Call us 866-733-6786. Dave in San Francisco. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask a somewhat provocative question in terms of the way you guys started as independents. And your feeling about, you know, the corporatization, creativity, and you know, how you guys and how you feel about people breaking off on their own, just trying their own thing. You know, I just read The Circle. I don't know if you have any comments on that, and that's my question. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
I didn't quite actually understand the question. The Circle?
I
didn't read The Circle.
I think he's talking about the balance between kind of independent production and more corporate production and where the new ideas, where the new films are coming from.
Well, one of the interesting aspects of technology is that the technology and the software and the skill sets are continually changing. There's nothing stable in that environment. And as the tools get better and faster, what it's allowing is for more people independently in smaller groups to be able to produce really high-quality work. That dynamic is continuing. So we see this, and we've seen this through the entire history, is that somebody will get something, they'll grab an idea, and they'll spin off in some way. So they may provide a service or they may have a product. And I don't see that dynamic changing, and I don't want it to change. I think it's one of the most exciting things about the field.
Speaking of the technology, the program that Pixar uses to animate its films, RenderMan, you're about to release it for free, non-commercially, that people will be able to use this admittedly large and complex program to, I guess, try their hand at animation themselves. What's the logic behind that?
Well, the RenderMan has been used for a number of years, and it's gone through continual evolution, and we just went through a major technical evolution for it. But as part of the technology, more people do have access to tools. So by making it free for non-commercial use, then we have a wider base of people who understand it and know how to use it. And out of that bigger base, there will be new opportunities. It's like the caller had asked, you know, about new things spawning off. Well, if you provide tools, whether they're hardware or software at all levels, then you're encouraging something new to happen, even though we don't know what it is. So that's a risk we take. Give it away for free. We think something good will happen, but we don't know for a fact.
Let me go back to a few more emails. Ben writes, what animated movie that was not made by Pixar did you like? Where do you draw inspiration, new inspiration from?
Well, the inspiration for the movies, again, actually goes to the directors. So our drive is to get them to do something. So the question is, what non-Pixar movies?
Yeah, what was the last non-Pixar animated movie you saw that made you go, wow, that was really beautiful?
Well, with the Disney film.
Oh, come on. Okay, let's make it a little tougher. What non-Pixar, non-Disney movie did you see?
Yeah, I understand. I've always loved Miyazaki's films. I mean, there's just something so incredibly different about the way he thought and the way he told stories that was very inspirational. And I really love those. I love the short films. I think short films are these little gems. They're examples of where small groups come together and they produce something to tell a little idea. And I've always found inspiration in those films.
Did you see How to Train Your Dragon 2?
You know, I didn't yet. And the reason was, frankly, I had so many things going on, I didn't get to see it, and then it was out of the theater. So I will see it when it comes out. And I heard good things about it. And
yes, very good.
And the director, Dean Devlawad, is a really good guy. I like him a lot.
Lance writes, how did Pixar balance the pressure of business interests and the art of making their creation? I bring this up given the problems with FX companies in Hollywood, the company Rhythm and Hues being an example. Rhythm and Hues basically went through California bankruptcy proceedings recently. How do you balance the business and the creative piece?
Well, and it's a tough question because Rhythm and Hues, led by John Hughes, John Hughes is one of the nicest guys you've ever met. And so here was a company that went through a lot, and in the end, they didn't make it. So it was actually, I think, unfortunate for the industry. But the difficulty is that the special effects business is really low margin. And with animation, then we own the whole process. That is, from the conceit of the idea through the release of the film.
So high cost, hard to make profit based on the high cost.
Yeah. So if you look at the animation studios, there's a different business model than the effects world, where the effects world, they're just doing a service. But the studios are just trying to lower their costs. And so they play the effects houses off against each other, or the tax incentives to lower their costs. So you understand it, but it's a world that I wouldn't want to be in because it's so difficult. And our view is we make the movie, we control everything about it from top to bottom, so we can ensure the quality, and we all have ownership in it. It's not like I'm making a film for somebody else, because it's just as hard to make a bad movie as it is a good movie.
What does the name Pixar mean?
Well, it's a made-up word. It's between Lauren Carpenter and Ali Ray Smith, who were trying to think of a word of the computer that we had designed at the time. So originally it was Pixar, P-I-X-E-R. Then they change it to an A to make it more verb-like.
Why is the logo a lamp?
Well, John's second short that he ever made with us was of a moving lamp. And this was a test for the software that we were making. And he wanted a Luxo lamp to come to life. So that first short called Luxo Jr. had this adult lamp and a small lamp. And this was, for me, one of those milestone pieces of animation when it came out. And it was so unusual in Canada, people didn't even know what to do about it. But we knew we had something big when the number one question after people saw this computer animated film was the big lamp a father or was it a mother?
Was it a mommy lamp or a daddy lamp?
Yes. Yeah, so when you get that question, okay, we got something here.
And that's the lamp we see jumping around in the Pixar logo at the beginning
of the movies.
Greg writes via email, why does every animated movie have to have one zany character that says random things, talks fast, acts in an overly eccentric way? Dory is the archetype. These characters overwhelm the real beauty of Pixar stories and frankly are the only thing that children remember from the movies.
Well, there's something that it's Walt Disney said and something we believe in is we don't make the movies for children. We make them for everybody. The way he said it was we make it for the child in everybody. And a lot of this comes from what the directors want. And I would say that not every film does have a funny little side character to it. They just vary. It's what they're going to take to tell the story. There are elements that are put in there that are meant to be emotional. But it's also fairly important that there be humor in the movies. That with any movie, there's a combination of the humor, the drama, the environment, and you want to get the balance right.
Before we let you go, we're almost out of time. I know Pixar's got some new projects coming out. Inside Out is a new movie coming out set about a little girl who's adjusting to life in San Francisco. Very briefly, in our last few minutes, what is the next thing you'd like Pixar to achieve? What's around the corner that you think that's going to be our next big goal? Briefly.
It's always to surprise people. That's what we want to do. We want to surprise them with something new and touch them. If we can do that, I feel good.
Ed Catmull is the co-founder and president of Pixar and the president of Walt Disney Animation. His new book is called Creativity Incorporated. Ed, it has been a pleasure to spend the hour with you. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Tina Laubert. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the music you are hearing now is from The Incredibles. I'm Joshua Johnson, your incredible guest host. Rachel Miro will continue to talk about the incorporated monsters in the news. I'm trying to make a Pixar pun. I think it worked. Thanks for spending the week with us. Have a great weekend. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.